Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher and our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us this week is Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Hi, good morning.
And also Julie Carr Smythe, correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
And Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome, Kathy.
Good morning.
Kathy, as predicted, Ohio lawmakers adjourned for just the year. There's another year left in the session, but for this year, without making headway on the crucial measure to better manage the state's unemployment compensation, why does this matter?
Well, this matters because if the state hits a recession or if the country hits a recession, which is widely anticipated, we're overdue for one, the fund will be depleted within a matter of months. It'll be unable to pay unemployment benefits. The state will have to then go back to the federal government and borrow because under federal law they're required to pay those benefits. That will result in higher taxes on businesses.
Because then they have to borrow from the feds. They have to pay fees on that.
Right.
And
the state
and the
has
businesses
to pay interest,
pay
and then the businesses pay a higher return.
Why then weren't they spurred to act?
Well, because the unemployment compensation system is funded by business taxes. So to shore up the fund, you have to raise tax on business. The argument that the supporters of the bill were putting forward was that what they were proposing, the additional payment that the businesses pay, would be less than if they had to borrow again. But the other part of the equation was they were asking labor for the first time for employees to start paying a premium tax, so they would be contributing towards the unemployment benefits as well. They want to cut benefits from 26 weeks to 24 weeks. So they're asking people on both sides of the equation, both the businesses that pay the tax and the employees that receive the benefits, to cut back on or pay more or cut back on what they receive. Nobody wants to do that.
Right. Andy Chow, what will it take?
Well, it's hard to say because when the negotiations started happening again, it was basically this time last year when House Republicans got together with labor and business and said, we're going to come up with a plan once and for all. It's going to be a kind of a compromise that everybody can agree on. We're going to sit down, hash this out, and we're going to have a plan ready to go. And that didn't happen. And when they were negotiating, when business, labor, and leaders, representatives were negotiating, kind of nothing came out of it. So Republican House Representative Kirk Schering came out with a bill and he said, all right, this is what I think we should do. Based on the negotiations I heard, this is what I think we should do. And nobody has really come out with strong support of it. And the labor side and more of the progressive groups say that it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't tax businesses enough. Business groups think that maybe it does tax them, and maybe they're okay with the tax increase, but they would like to see a cut in benefits on the labor side a little bit more to save some money on that end.
I just think both sides are never going to come together on this. After
so actually, lawmakers have to actually do
political will.
Their job.
Political will. Yeah. I mean, they're going to have to push it through, don't you?
They're going to have to be the bad guys and take a vote on something that one side is not going to be happy with.
One or both sides. Right. And, you know, at a time when our governor's sort of promoting bipartisan compromise and bringing people together, I mean, it really needs to get done. It's sort of a housekeeping thing that they have just been delaying for so long.
Well, is it going to be an 11th hour thing a year from now, do you suspect? A lame duck session, sort of a...
I would vote against anything happening more than for something happening. I mean, that would be my intuition, just because this has been so difficult and there's strong constituency groups on both sides of this issue. Business groups, you know, this is a Republican majority, House and Senate. Business groups have a lot of sway with them. And, you know, even if their associations kind of come to an agreement, there's other folks that kind of deal with the lawmakers that can, you know, persuade them otherwise. Likewise, you know, there's some labor groups that have persuasion as well. So I think it's just a really difficult thing to get done. And I just don't see, you know, I've heard, you know, through the grapevine that some people think doing nothing is the best solution and just wait until they have to borrow again and deal with it then.
And I think there was a thought that maybe they could get something done earlier in the year, maybe if they got it done this past April, because that's the kind of political climate that would have made it easier to get things done. Now we're heading into next year where everybody's running for office again. They're running for re-election.
Right.
Nobody wants this on their back trying to run for office, and they don't want to say, well, you voted for this or against this.
Hmm. Okay, didn't get done.
Now, the important thing before you go on to note is that if the fund goes broke, employees who lose their jobs and are eligible for benefits still get paid. They have to get paid.
It's the federal government law. Yeah. So the state will have to borrow from the feds.
State will have to borrow. So nobody's not going to get their unemployment benefits.
So labor's with the status quo, all things being equal.
Yeah. I mean, if I were labor. Yeah.
And it'd be nice to get something done as soon as possible, because then when you revamp that system, you need to start paying into that pot more, get it ready, get it shored up for the recession. So it's you need some time to build that
stockpiling
fund up.
The funds, right? Mm-hmm. All right. They did pass a measure that would ban abortions in the case of fetuses diagnosed with possible Down syndrome. Julie Carr-Smyth, how big of a deal is this?
Well, we're only the third state to try this, and in Indiana, it has been blocked by the court as unconstitutional. I would say it's not going to affect a whole lot of instances, but it sends a pretty strong message that we're beginning down a road of basing abortion decisions on individual cases. So if you've got Down syndrome, maybe next time it's attempting to ban abortions based on gender or based on race or based on the
any other genetic type of abnormality as well, right?
And other abnormalities, right. So it's a pretty big deal. I suspect Kasich will sign it. There's a lot of pressure on him not to sign it, obviously, from the abortion rights groups who are saying this is another restriction. The pro-life side has pushed it as a discrimination issue, that that people are just ill-informed about Down syndrome. But the bill itself does not provide any additional education that I recall on to people at the clinic on what this is.
Yeah,
what Down syndrome
does. How do you enforce
it?
Well, I'm trying to figure out what triggers enforcement of it. How does it even work? I have not been able to figure that out. Do you guys know? Who would report it? Isn't it physician-patient confidential information, if you even get a genetic test and what the results of those are?
I have the same questions you have. I don't know how you enforce something like this.
And these are the questions that have been brought up in committee.
How do they respond to that?
Well, I think they just say let's roll with it and move forward and see how it goes. There was a huge the Julie brought up the biggest question, which was a lot of people came forward in committee saying this is going to be struck down by the courts. This is going to be a huge court battle, and
that sounds like what must be what they want then.
And the lawmakers said that's. They think that they can win a court battle.
This is Ohio Right to Life's number one agenda item this year. This was their number one bill that they wanted to get passed.
Right.
And if you think
remember that the abortion, the anti-abortion community is on the record as saying they're trying to trigger a challenge that they think will possibly
the heartbeat
overturn.
Bill is likely to do that, but
to overturn Roe v. Wade and get that back before a court that has turned more conservative, a U.S. Supreme Court, in the interceding years. So we just have to see where this goes. Maybe no one, as you say, is going to turn their doctor in for this. There were some people who testified who said, yes, I was pregnant with a Down syndrome child that I had, but here are the problems that I see with that. And then there were those who said, I had a Down syndrome child and have loved that child.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's an interesting sort of flip because of the fact that aborting a fetus that doesn't have Down syndrome would seem to also entail, people
discriminating against fetuses that are normal and healthy.
Right. It's more of a strategy for a legal challenge than anything else. I mean, I just don't think it's enforceable.
When you look at the game plan of Ohio Right to Life and groups that support Ohio Right to Life, they want to pass bans that kind of go right up to that line where it could be challenged in court, but they think that they could win that court battle. And then when they do get up to that line and win, then they move a little bit further and a little bit further, because they make no secret.
Chipping away.
Make no secret about the fact that they want an all-out ban on abortion someday. And that's why they're against the heartbeat bill, because the heartbeat bill would go. That's why the Ohio Right to Life is against the heartbeat bill, because that went outside of the game plan. That went
too far over the line.
And they aren't against it as much as they're neutral on it. Mm-hmm. They've decided not to take a stand, which is – it is interesting, because they just thought it wouldn't – this would be more of a sympathetic kind of issue with the public to say, oh, yeah. And they used a report, I might add, out of – was it Iceland – that showed some – it was erroneous, but it showed that – or it was taken out of context that nearly all Down syndrome had been obliterated in Iceland through abortion. And when I did the research on the actual report, one, it didn't quite say that. Two, it was not a government enforced, which is what they made it sound like. The government there
was forcing
people to do this in order to, you know, create a master race or something. It was not that. But I talked to a number of even the sponsors of the bill who thought that was factual and were proceeding based on the idea that some countries were using that kind of abortion.
Do any of you know, as far as the court, there is one state that's in court over this, I think you said?
Indiana.
Indiana. Mm-hmm. Do you know what triggered that court case? Was it just it wasn't a particular case of a child aborted, a fetus aborted?
No, I think it was just a constitutional challenge.
Okay.
And that one is much broader. It is on all genetic anomalies, if I remember correctly, or a number of them, including gender and race. And then there's one other state, North Dakota, I think, has passed something, and theirs is not been challenged. There haven't even been any cases of these sort of abortions being requested.
Governor Kasich's expected to sign this into law. This would be the 19th or 20th
restriction on abortion
since he's taken office 7 years ago. They've got one more year with him. And then, you know, all bets are off at this point about who will replace John Kasich in the governor's office, whether it's, you know, another conservative Republican.
Abortion remains, you know, a really important issue when people vote for governor and other offices. I mean, it's a big issue for a lot of voters.
We've seen that nationally. I mean, we know that a huge strategy for Trump winning was that even people within Ohio Right to Life who did not like Donald Trump, the person or his character, they said, listen, he is the one who is going to appoint anti-abortion judges. So that was the one that I know sold it for a lot of people. So, I mean, that it has become the issue for a lot of people still.
And that, of course, that's a legacy he'll leave long after he leaves office, because those folks on the court serve for life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, it still remains a wedge issue. There was a protest in the Senate chamber of this, a group that stood up with T-shirts that said, spelled out, stop the bans. There were protests. So it will be a wedge issue, I think, in the election, as opposed to a unifying issue, which is interesting.
Okay.
And I think for those on the side of supporting abortion rights, based on the testimony I watched, this is going to be sort of a bridge too far that might be a case they can make for their supporters to say, listen, now we're getting into the real doctor's offices here. We're getting into personal decisions about and this is not even knowledge that for sure the fetus has
Down
syndrome.
It only can be a genetic propensity. It's not there. They don't guarantee one way or the other.
Right. I mean, that kind of testing can't say 100%
right
for sure anyway. And so, as you say, enforcement-wise, what is going to happen? This person comes in and says, you know, because it's an amniocentesis kind of test, I think, that used to be required for so-called older mothers that were like 30.
It's not amnio. It's at the 12-week stage, and it's something – it's called something different, but it's the same sort of thing. It's just not – the amniotic fluid hasn't – the sac hasn't built up yet. It's something a little more invasive.
But for opponents, it gets very uncomfortable because it really gets into a woman's reasoning, you know, personal reasoning for an abortion, which – you know, most people don't like to share their decision-making reasons for something so personal.
I know. Is there going to be a requirement? Is there going to be something on a form? And what's going to stop you from just lying?
What it is that the doctor, there would be proof that the doctor had knowledge that the woman had the test and that it came back. So, but like you say, this would require, as far as I can tell, the patient turning in the doctor when the patient is the one seeking the procedure. And also there are no penalties on the women. So
right.
It is important to note that they are working on criminalizing as best they can the activities of abortion doctors so they can put them out of business.
We will continue our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press. Also with us is Kathy Kandisky at the Columbus Dispatch and Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press. Julie, a group of local investors who did not get a state license to grow medical marijuana, has announced plans for a statewide ballot issue that would legalize marijuana across the board. This happened after last week's show a week ago last Monday. Is this sour grapes, first of all, or would this have happened anyway?
I think that it is a little bit of sour grapes in the sense that they did not get the issue. But part of it is that these folks had pushed it earlier, and my sense of it is that they are looking at this as sort of a bait and switch by the administration. Because if you remember, they pushed the ballot issue, it failed, and the legislature went in and passed a law. There's a lot of feeling that they have not, that the state has sort of been dragging its feet, has not been giving people enough time. The procedure hasn't been as transparent as it should be. And so every development has sort of been slow in coming. And they then found out something about the process of selecting the finalists that was that one of the people on that panel had a conviction for marijuana.
A felony conviction for.
And was not forthcoming about it. He did not.
Right.
But nobody asked him about it.
Right. I mean, the process maybe didn't even require asking him. So it's unclear.
It's unclear what the process was.
Yeah. It
just raises questions about the process.
This has been 3 weeks, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And we still don't know what their process is.
From what it sounds like the Department of Commerce or the the Marijuana Control Commission said that they – I mean, it's still unclear, but it sounds like they were basically saying, well, we expected them to not have a criminal conviction, or we expected them to be
people
to tell
who
us.
Are knowledgeable about these sort of things. You wouldn't be surprised that they have a criminal conviction.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
But that seems like the lamest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. I do think it'd be one thing if he said it and if they did their due diligence to find out ahead of time.
Right.
If all of that was transparent from the beginning, I don't know how big of a deal it would be because Kathy's right. I mean,
well, it's kind of like the Democrats' failure to know that Ed Fitzgerald. I mean,
right.
That
yeah. Right?
What's his name?
Yeah, it was Ed Fitzgerald.
Ed Fitzgerald had a and then a whole bunch of stuff right. to be concerned about.
And that's why, in that way, the fact that they say we're going back to the ballot, I think is it's not exactly sour grapes, but it's more. We should have expected this because they tried it before. Then this process got created. So once they began having issues with the process, they're like, listen, voters want this. Voters in Ohio have shown in these polls that they do. And so this is their threat,
that's the hammer they can bring, isn't it? I mean, three years have passed.
They would not have done this if they had been picked as cultivators.
Because they could make money doing that.
Because these are the people who, when they did put it on the ballot, they wrote the language in a certain way so they could carve out a good deal for about 10 people, including themselves. And so
and voters opposed that.
And I think that's a huge reason why they opposed it. It was not a free market approach. It was that word that we had to say, oligopoly or
oligopoly.
I mean, how many of you have heard your friends say, oh, I'm going to become a pot grower? Yep. I mean, people joke about it, like people who are looking for work and stuff like that. Oh, here's an opportunity. Well, there was an opportunity because it was all spelled out who was going to get the work.
Right. And really high licensing fees.
And that's exactly. A big difference with this proposal. As it would allow anybody who's 21 or older to grow pot in their home and to sell it.
Think of it like alcohol.
So the
regulations that we have in alcohol, they want to make that for pot as well.
I'm thinking.
But yeah,
this is the season.
Yeah. I think it's just interesting to me that the guy with the conviction came to light only after they lost the license because. Mm-hmm. They could have brought that up the process right. at a committee meeting, brought it to the commission mm-hmm. and said, hey, you know,
by the
we're going to challenge
you know?
This.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they could have done it on the record, but they could have done it within the process. So they waited until they didn't get
so
the
license. So that sounds certainly like sour
dropped
grapes.
Dropped a bomb. And yeah. Now we have the legislators saying, maybe we'll revisit this whole thing.
But they're saying that they can't revamp the process for picking the pickers. I mean, picking the people who...
Screening the
applicants because it would create an inconsistency. So the guy with the felony conviction for growing pot and with the intention of selling it, who pleaded guilty.
Yeah, well, he made a plea deal to get some type of probation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's going to still be one of the scorers.
Well, he was the scorer and he already scored it and the
yeah.
cultivators were picked. And so what they're saying is, well, if this guy was not on the up and up, then they have to go all the
right.
way back to an earlier stage in the process to pick the pickers. And then redo all the scoring.
And they've already been slow as molasses in January with the whole thing.
So the idea is...
So it may never get done.
I mean, it's supposed to
does it
be
seem
open
like this
by...
this is all by design?
Yeah.
I mean, does it really seem like this is all by design?
Oh, my gosh.
This is why you have a simple law that just says you're going to legalize marijuana and you're going to, you know, let people grow it if they want or have set amounts and stuff like that and make it as simple as possible.
Mm-hmm. 3 years has passed, though, since the November 2015 when voters, every single county in the state of Ohio, all 88 voted against it. But 3 years have passed. So there's a couple things going on. This is a much different proposal that would go on the ballot if they get the signatures and if they get the language approved. And there's a whole new constituency of people growing up becoming old enough to vote.
Yeah, but I think the big catch here is, as far as I know, there is no official language right now.
No.
So the thing is, they say they want to do this and that and the other thing, but it's still important to wait for the language because these are the same people who carved out a special deal for a certain group of people.
Right,
so.
In the Constitution, and that just wasn't going to float with the voters.
And as far as the conviction triggering this whole review, it's just ironic. I mean, Peter Lewis funded the entire recreational marijuana movement in this country, and he had so many marijuana convictions. Like, they didn't care about that at the time, so now they care.
You mean the Gould folks?
Right.
Yeah.
The requirement to be a screener, to be the picker, is have an in-depth knowledge of how to cultivate and distribute marijuana.
Right. People that support legalized marijuana are often people who
have
partaken, perhaps, and may have some kind of on their record, so nobody should be surprised by this. The question is, what are the rules for the process?
Mm-hmm. And was everybody transparent and accountable when?
An inconsistency. You can't have had a prior conviction if you want to grow it and apply for one of the licenses, but you can have a prior conviction if you're one of the people that screens the license applicants. Does that make sense? So a licensee applicant cannot have a prior conviction.
Right.
But
right?
A screener can.
But a screener can.
Right.
And I think that's where the kind of the hypocrisy comes in.
It just it just mucks up the whole process. People that don't like this whole issue can point to this as a reason to not like it further. I mean, it just mucks up the whole process. Mm-hmm.
I should be careful not to malign Peter Lewis. I mean, he may have had a lot of arrests, and those might not have been convictions. I haven't looked at his record lately, but he's well known for
She's talking about the other guy. Like, comparatively, there are other people out there who, they have things on their record related to marijuana, which makes sense why they would like to legalize it.
But it does seem public opinion has swayed on this issue a little bit. At least it seems
that way.
Every
year that goes by,
it seems like it's inevitable.
Yeah.
There are now.
It's like, who controls it at this
who
point?
Who controls
is the question.
It? Who gets rich from it seems to be the issue that needs to be resolved.
There are now degrees in higher education in states like California, Colorado that have legalized it for learning how to do the process and build businesses. And it's a completely different world, I would say, than it was 3 years ago.
It's not your grandpa's marijuana business anymore. Let's move on. Well, let's see. Endorsements. An interesting one. Connie Pillich, former state rep and running mate. Correct me. No,
she ran for state treasurer.
State treasurer in the last go around. She got an endorsement from former Democratic National Committee chairman and former Pennsylvania governor Ed Rendell. Interesting. You know, it looks like things are gearing up for some competition.
I thought it was very interesting that, you know, he's sort of known as being the people's mayor. He was in Philadelphia as the mayor for a while. And him siding with her when possibly – we don't really know exactly what Obama is going to do. It's sort of presumed that he would be behind Richard Cordray, who was the consumer chief federally, but also Betty Sutton worked for the Obama administration and was an appointee. But to have Rendell is another big name, known certainly
among Democrats.
Right.
Right.
And certainly grassroots-wise and campaigning-wise, he's a real no-nonsense kind of guy. He also has a military record that they can use to highlight her military record. It just mixed it up a little bit at a point when, after Cordray announced, I think there was some thinking, at least among us pundits, that, you know, it would sort out the field a little bit, and it really did not.
Not yet.
I think, I mean, based on the reaction for when Cordray officially jumped in, I think it was a little more lukewarm than they expected. I think people thought there would be way more hype around him actually jumping in, but I think the problem is he waited months to actually resign and finally jump in.
That, he had to, by the way. But yeah.
And so I feel like the idea of Rich Cordray running for governor was kind of – it talked itself out. And then I think when he finally did do it, it was just not as big of a splash as people thought.
And you had these four other candidates, Connie Pillich included, who had been kind of working for months on their campaigns. And I think to some it almost felt like, you know, they'd been paying their dues, and just to get pushed aside because Cordray jumps in was kind of disrespectful, kind of wrong, kind of, you know, not nice. And I think they kind of, you know, you're seeing that now. I think that endorsement is very interesting. That gives Pillich a boost when she really needs it.
And you got to remember the four candidates who have been in it.
Joe Schiavone, state senator, Connie Pillich, former state rep, and
Betty Sutton, former U.S. rep, and then
and also a member of the Ohio General Assembly at one point.
And Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley.
So these are the four candidates who have been in it the longest. They've been the most established as far as candidates go. And they've done two debates right. so far.
Well,
so,
debates.
But I mean, they've been doing the work.
Yeah.
They've been doing the work. And I think if
and they've
if,
been
if
vetted. Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think if Cordray would have jumped in a little earlier, I think maybe one or two candidates would have been like, OK, I'm not seeing the kind of fundraising. Before putting too much work into this, maybe I'll drop
out
now.
Maybe before Labor Day or something uh-huh. like that. Yeah.
And but now they've done the work. They've been prepping. They've right. wrapped their heads around
they've
being
had
governor.
Policy mm-hmm. introductions, and
we should mention that Supreme Court Justice Bill O'Neill is also in the race,
him.
Although he hasn't really been doing the same kind of work.
Has Cordray been vetted yet? Because that was one of the reasons why he couldn't participate in that last.
So I think that's still in the process. Because you're right. He ended up. Not officially jumping in until a day or two after the latest debate
oh, okay.
forum.
Or the day of or something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's because the Democratic Party wanted to vet him.
Because
vetting didn't
hard.
Go well last time
yeah.
around.
Lack thereof, yeah.
And so,
but,
yeah.
But speaking of marijuana, this is really the reason that Bill O'Neill is staying in the race. You remember that he said he would definitely get out of the race when Cordray got in.
And then he said, changed his mind.
He said, maybe I will if I can get him on board on my ideas about marijuana.
I wondered where you were going with that for a minute, but now I get it.
But
and so really, honestly, I mean, that is one of his key issues and the reason why he says he's going to stick around because he thought back when he was dabbling with an idea of running that he would try to urge the party further left.
And why would anyone think that Richard Cordray would go all
former
out?
Former attorney general.
Former attorney general.
Now, Bill O'Neill has said he's going to resign from the Supreme Court. I forget the date exactly.
Somewhere in January.
Somewhere in January. Yeah.
Before
to run
the deadline.
For governor. And
file.
Now I'm going to throw a question out here. Are you guys convinced he's going to step aside?
No.
No, me neither.
No, I don't like the attention.
Am I convinced that he's gonna resign as a Supreme Court
and to
justice?
Run for governor?
No, I'm not convinced of that either. But him announcing that kind of puts the brakes on these Republicans who have been criticizing him because they say that he's been politicking as a judge, which you're not supposed to do. And so he says, "Well, I'm going to resign in January," and I think that gives him some time to kind of weigh his options a little bit more. And see how the field is playing out. Talk
right.
to these.
And one of the lawyers who is against him politicking while he's on the court is the highest lawyer in the state, the Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, who has said he should be off the court by now. This is a total
She's
violation
ticked.
Of the
yeah.
code of judicial conduct.
I think you could say hair on fire.
Ticked, hair on fire. That's our continuum.
And a reminder that Bill O'Neill's the only elected Democrat statewide right now. But when he won,
no one knew who he was when he won.
Right. What it was the Republicans kind of got punished for a really nasty campaign ploy against him. That looked back at some of his decisions, I think, involving rape or something like that. And people just reacted in the very last moment and elected him over this nasty campaign.
You can't,
also,
I mean,
his name
yeah, I was
is O'Neill.
Say, I don't want to dismiss.
Ohio voters have
O'Neill,
a thing about
I love
names.
O'Neill.
He
yeah.
ran against, he ran O'Neill against Brown. The incumbent named Cupp, and his name was O'Neill. And I think that had a lot to do with it, too.
Oh, those... What do you say about the Ohio voter?
I don't know. And I think O'Neill will be getting pressure to stay on the court from the Democratic Party mm-hmm. because he's the only Democrat on the court.
Although how many candidates for anything in the Democratic Party are going to want Bill O'Neill to show up at their campaign fundraisers?
Well, and
I mean, I don't know.
I forget the specifics, but he cannot run again because he's about to reach his age limit.
Yeah.
No, but when he steps down, the Republican governor Kasich would get to name the replacement.
Right.
So the Democrats would be handing the seat.
Right.
Whereas
and I believe
creating an incumbency.
If he serves all the way to the end, it'll be after the new governor's
seat.
In. Yep. Right?
Yeah.
It'll be after the new governor's in and there would just be a normal race where somebody would run against somebody.
To fill the seat.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll continue our conversation on our weekly reporter roundtable. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Still with us is Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press. We're going to turn our sights now to a few things, just looking back over the 20 year of 2017. It is our last official weekly Reporter Roundtable before year's end. And I wanted to talk one thing. We have one more year with John Kasich at the helm of state government. He is continuing a weekly appearance on national television. This is not let up at all. In fact, it seems like it's almost increased, or it's just a regular thing. And this week, he talked about the GOP losing the future as young voters drift away. Is he worried about just Ohio or the nation or what?
I think he's thinking about what John Kasich's next job's going to be. Okay. I mean, I think he's trying to keep himself viable on the national stage. I think he's continuing to beat this drum about bipartisanship, hoping that it'll catch fire, perhaps give him a pathway to the presidential race next time. I think that's where...
Or maybe a gig on television?
I think there's a lot of people who call themselves Republicans out there who don't like President Trump, and they're asking themselves, where do they belong in this crazy world? And I think he wants to be the person that says, I am your Republican. You can be a Kasich Republican. And I think he's just trying to establish that base for whatever his next move will be. You mentioned what kind of year has it been with the governor really focusing on national talking points. And I don't know what you all think, but it's been a really strange year as far as policymaking goes. Because what I've experienced in the past is that the governor goes up, he delivers his State of the State address, and he lays out a pretty aggressive agenda for what he wants to see have happened. And then from there, the House and the Senate lay out their agenda, and then we move on to the bill-making process. And then we see this bill and that bill, and we see these issues and that issues. And it feels like that wasn't really the case, and when the governor did give his address, it was more on tackling the opioid crisis and then a lot of national talking points. But it seems like Kasich isn't really leading the charge on state policymaking agenda as he has in the past.
Well, he's a lame duck. I mean, no question about that.
And so then the House and the Senate kind of did their own thing, and it's been a lot more scattered and not as many bills.
Unemployment comp, for instance, everybody knows they need to fix it, but the governor's been silent on it.
Yeah. Them.
I mean, he's really not taken much of a leadership role.
Right. He hasn't. I would say he hasn't been as present of a force in the state of Ohio this year as in the past. And he definitely, we watch, and your listeners certainly do watch, as he tries to make mostly national points and points about the country. My take on this idea of what he's up to in terms of why he's promoting it, like Kathy says, in part, it's, you know, what's the future of John Kasich? But I feel as if he's fighting for the relevance or relevancy of political parties. It doesn't matter to him and Joe Biden whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. It's like, are we going to have a party structure in this country, or is it just going to be a random Twitter-based everybody goes around and
about. The tail's wagging the dog.
Right.
You know, where it's the candidate and not the party anymore.
Right.
And like, so a la Donald Trump.
Right. And I think that certainly if you watch the president's tweets, he talks a lot about, you know, listen, voters, I'm coming straight to you because you can't trust the media and you can't trust the politicians. And it's really a shall I say, a new day in politics. And John Kasich is trying to be out there sort of speaking for some sort of reason. But I think it is self-preservation.
But again, in the meantime, it's just been scattered as far as policymaking goes here on the state side. And I mean, I think you saw that with the budget. Usually when the governor introduces his budget and then it rolls through the House and Senate, there's a lot of intervention by the governor's office to kind of make sure that it's on the right track, to avoid a lot of line item vetoes and to avoid a lot of contention. This time, I think there were correct me if I'm wrong, but I think more than 40 line item vetoes. The House and Senate were mad about a lot of them.
Well, they overrode.
The House voted to override many vetoes, and then the Senate made it official with several official vetoes.
More than any time
in
history.
He's never, and right.
Here it is, a House, by the way, an Ohio General Assembly that's massively dominated by his party.
He has a super majority in the House for
but
Republicans.
But he's not. I mean, you know, he's angered some of the folks in his party, particularly with the Medicaid expansion that he promoted several years ago, and has had to defend repeatedly as conservatives in the House and Senate have tried to roll it back or add to it.
But they didn't. They could have, couldn't they?
They could have. But, you know, now it gets to the point where you're going to take health insurance away from people, especially when Congress is talking about doing it for you. I think they were happy to sit back. But I think I don't expect Kasich to do any major initiatives in his last year in office. I think the game plan all along for him has been to do things kind of in the early years and then shore those things up to make sure they're sustainable in the last 2 years of office. I think that's kind of been where he's headed. It's a lot more, from our perspective, more boring things going on behind the scenes at this point.
Right. I mean, I think the opioid crisis is going to be front and center. My prediction would be in the governor's race, and he'll need to talk about efforts and accomplishments there. But the numbers continue to rise, the deaths, the inability to really pinpoint what's happening and why it's happening is stunning. I mean, the fact that there's just no really good answers. There is this technology type challenge that Kasich urged the Third Frontier Commission to get involved in, and they are starting to award those grants. It'll be interesting to see if any of those are ideas that can come to market, things like alternatives to opioid use, prescription painkiller use, and alternatives like other sort of medical issues.
Medical and marijuana.
Apps and things that look at, you know, targeting or figuring out better like the risks of addiction and where they're popping up and that sort of thing. But all those are just sort of ideas now that have gotten some seed funding.
Yeah, there's one that got, I think, $3 million is this creation of a new kind of pill where the pill would only release the amount of pain-reducing substance needed. So even if you take more than the prescribed amount, the pill would only release what you need.
Smart and then, pills.
Mm-hmm, and then stop releasing so that you can't
smart
over.
Smart pills?
I don't know.
There you go. You should. Yeah.
I said it first.
Yeah.
They've really taken care of the prescription opioid problem, though. You know, but the problem I think is that people that have legitimate pain are finding it more difficult to get the medications that they need. For people that are just recreational users, I think what you're seeing is most of those folks have moved to street drugs like heroin,
and that's just settled in for a long cold winter. It sounds like, and that's what they're battling now.
And then with fentanyl appearing in these drugs, that's making the death toll rise.
And it's affecting almost every other agency in the state that matters. Obviously, prisons, child and family services, county children's services in the counties. Are just seeing a horrible rate increase in the number of kids.
And businesses who say they can't find folks to pass drug tests.
Right.
I mean, it's affecting every aspect of our lives, and it's costing taxpayers billions and billions of dollars.
I think it'll be interesting to see what the governor and what lawmakers do this coming year as far as let me back up. I think we've seen a lot to do with prevention, trying to prevent people from forming addiction in the first place. But I don't know if we've seen as much as far as on the treatment side and the recovery side. And so I think it'll be interesting to see if we'll see a huge amount of money pumped into treatment to make sure that people are getting the treatment where they need treatment, getting the recovery services they need, the support they need.
And in terms of the monetary impact, we do have this outstanding lawsuit that Mike DeWine filed against the pharmaceutical makers, companies, sort of, you know, putting blame on them for culpability in some of the addiction that was caused by painkillers.
Which so got the show on the road.
That will, you know, continue rolling out through the new year, developments in that.
A lot of people think those folks should pay for the mess they've created.
Yeah, and the distributors as well, was of which, you know, which includes Cardinal, big company based here in Columbus.
But that's not – the distributors are not on the state.
It is in other states, but not in this state.
And it is in other city lawsuits. I believe Dayton, I think Columbus may have just filed a lawsuit as well. Medina. Right. So a lot of cities are taking on manufacturers and distributors. DeWine and the state have only taken on the manufacturers at this point.
So we have one more year in the Ohio General Assembly's two-year session. Mm-hmm. We don't have a governor that's very active at the state level. He didn't even get involved, at least not yet, in the unemployment compensation issue of how they're going to fund going forward, coming, you know, and how they're going to prepare for the next recession. Who do you see in the Ohio General Assembly leading the charge on anything at this point? Because they're, at least in the House particularly, they're in a re-election mode as well. You mentioned that the unemployment compensation, nothing might get done on that because nobody wants to do that in an election cycle.
I don't think you're going to see a lot. I think you're going to see mostly people raising money and running for office, especially, I mean, in the House, obviously, they're all up.
Yeah, and it does take a lighter tone usually.
Typically, anyway.
Right, typically. So you'll see that they probably won't do a lot of stuff. We'll have a really busy lame duck session after the election, and they'll push through any number of things that are out there.
I think we might see some movement on congressional redistricting, some way to reform the way congressional districts are drawn. I think there's an effort to put that on the ballot in November, and I think lawmakers would rather try to come up with a deal before then.
They would, but the group that wants to put it on the ballot has said they're collecting signatures no matter what they're putting on the ballot because they don't trust the General Assembly to put something out there that they like.
And I think the idea is, well, we're putting on the ballot what lawmakers already created for the state legislative district. Right. So why do we need
and
the
voters understand that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that came up last week is that the capital budget will be starting in January. And Secretary of State John Husted is asking for money for an upgrade of the voting machines all over the state. So his proposal is $118 million that would fund the lowest cost upgrade, which would be optical scan machines. If they want something, it's a nice compromise, according to the association, the Election Officials Association, because it does give the county some money. But if they want something more fancier or what they deem better, they have to cover the difference.
And they have to get that done so that they can do one test election before the big national general election in 2020.
It's a good time for it.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll see. I want to wish you a very happy new year. Thanks, all of you, for joining us. Kathy Kandisky from The Dispatch, thanks to you. Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you.
Thanks.
And Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, thank you.
Always good to be here.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. You can like us on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Have a great day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.